This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1989, Thai kickboxing hit America's radar with a reverse roundhouse kick.
Take your bag and leave my house.
What's going on?
You don't want training.
Hey, you want me to break my leg?
Your brother. Remember?
That is a young and very fit Jean-Claude Van Damme seeking revenge in the 1989 film Kickboxer. But as dramatic and intense as the film's final showdown may have been, it does not hold a candle to the realities of the Muay Thai kickboxing scene in Thailand, as British journalist Alexander Reynolds discovered when he first entered the Rompo Muay Thai gym in Bangkok a decade ago. Alexander wrote about his experiences as a professional kickboxer in Thailand in an article for Vice called The Seedy Underworld of Muay Thai Boxing. And Alexander Reynolds, great to have you back with us on Word of Mouth.
Ah, konsabari mai kap. That's hello in Thai.
Well, thank you so much for translating. There's a lot that gets translated in this, especially, you know, your motivation for becoming a Thai kickboxer. How did you even wind up kickboxing in Thailand in the first place?
Well, my wife was a civil servant. She worked for the British government and we got posted there. And I couldn't believe my lucky stars because I'd actually been a Thai boxer ever since I was 19, learning the game in the grimy gyms of London's East End and rainy Manchester.
You mentioned the CD gyms where you trained initially, the Rompo Gym in Bangkok. Tell us about that one.
Well, we were billeted on a road in central Bangkok. And as luck would have it, the local Thai boxing gym was the gym to go to if you were a Nak Muay Farang, a foreign Thai boxer. And the promoter there was a chap called Mr. Peck. Now, I didn't know this, but the gym was also rumored to be the mafia gym. So I went down there and I signed up and pretty soon I was fighting on the bill with the rest of the chaps.
How did you discover the mafia connection at the gym?
It was quite subtle, really, because it's something you don't really notice at first. But then when you've got all of these sort of fat bellies and these oily hustlers coming in and out of the gym and seeing these big wads of money being traded and various fights and arguments between promoters, sometimes there was fears that these guys would come back with guns and start shooting up the gym. It was then that I realized that something was amiss.
Now, you were a Farang. Is that the right way to put
it? Yeah.
Okay.
A foreigner of Western descent. It's derived from the Thai word for French, Farangset.
So how were the Farang regarded in the Rompo gym?
Well, very marketable, because Thais love to see their boys fighting foreigners and they love to see their boys beating foreigners. However, times are changing. A lot of Westerners who were turning up at Rompo Gym and various other gyms in Thailand, like in Bangkok, like Jitties, for instance, these guys were very adept. They had very good hands. They were very well schooled in the gyms that they came from in the West. So it was a lot more competitive and not as easier for the Thais as they thought it would be.
You describe this kind of gym living on the margins. Describe the scene for us at an actual fight. Who's there? What does it look like? How many people?
There are thousands of people just baying and screaming and shouting. And you have to totally zone out and focus just totally on yourself. And when you're actually walking into the ring, it's very difficult to screen all of that out. Because if you don't, you're going to lose and you're going to be unhinged. And then when, of course, you climb into the ring and you're facing the other guy, you've got all of the people around the ring screaming and shouting at you. And it's actually very unnerving to see people contorted like that and baying for your blood.
And you were put in the ring with several Thai fighters and other Farangs. Did you fight differently than you had learned back home?
Yeah, certainly my game got better. I got a lot more powerful and my kicking improved and my knees improved. And also I was able to use my elbows and I've got very sharp elbows and I wasn't allowed to use those when I was fighting in the West, in the UK, for instance. You weren't allowed to elbow to the head, but you were allowed to knee to the body.
There are officials and regulations here in the US. Any kind of governance there in Thailand?
Well, there wasn't any drug testing in the sport. which shocked me. And also what shocked me as well was going to the local chemist and discovering that I could buy any steroid that I wanted over the counter, no questions asked. So that would help some fighters. They would take clenbuterol if they needed to lose weight quickly, or if they needed to bump up a weight, if they were moving from, say, light heavyweight to super heavyweight, they would take something like HGH or nandrolone and they could bump up the weight, no problem.
You actually were faced with having to lose a lot of weight before a fight. Tell us about the circumstances that set that up.
Yeah, losing weight is really difficult. And I turned professional in my 30s. I was 35 years old. And when I turned up at the gym, I was over my fight weight. So I had to lose, I lost in total about 40 pounds in weight. And a lot of that I'd accrued from things like weightlifting and drinking beer and stuff like that and not watching my diet. Mm-hmm. So I lost a lot of strength going down. And it was having to find a sort of happy medium within which to work. So because you cannot lose the weight too quickly. But quite often promoters would ask you to lose the weight very quickly for you to make fights.
Well, they asked you to lose weight very quickly and then set you in the ring with somebody who was 20 pounds heavier.
Yeah, that happened quite a lot. That actually happened to me once. I was fighting a guy who was 10 pounds heavier and I lost the fight. There was no Rocky-style comeback victory for me on that. But that was a setup that was quite common. And that's when you realize that the whole thing is a fix. The sport only really exists for gambling. And you're just a non-durable commodity. And at the end of the day, it's a revolving door. One guy's going to come in and another guy's going to go out. And also the life of a lot of these Nakmwais, especially the indigenous people, the Thais, there was a lot of child exploitation. A lot of children were sold off to gyms as indentured servants. They wouldn't earn any money and they would have to fight to live. And that was actually quite sickening to see that. It nauseated me and it sort of opened up my eyes. You know, when you see a small child at no more than 11 years old whipped with a skipping rope for refusing to train, you can't close your eyes to it.
Yeah, that's a terrible picture. But for you, the other fighters, did they make money? Did you make money?
No, the most money I ever made from one bout was about $500. But I wasn't really in it for the money. I mean, I've always been in it for the love of the sport, but also the love of the art. And I think the love of the art transcends the organized sport. And now that I'm getting older now, I've been a Nakmwai for 25 years. I'm 44 now. I'm easing down.
So the promoters are making money largely from gambling. Fighters not making that much money. Is betting on fights legal in Thailand?
Not high scale betting, but betting. Gambling is technically illegal, like prostitution is technically illegal, but it still goes on. Mm-hmm. And if you go to Lumpini or Ratchathon Nern Stadium in Bangkok, you will see the furious betting that goes on around the ring. And you can't say that it's illegal or it doesn't exist because it's going on all around you, but it's just not acknowledged. And there's a lot of kickbacks and there's a lot of interest to keep it that way.
Did the promoters treat the Farangs, the foreigners, and the Thai boxers differently?
Yes, they were slightly more respectful to the Westerners because they automatically thought the Westerners were wealthier and they didn't know where they were coming from or whom they knew. I mean, I never really got messed around by our first promoter, Mr. Peck, or indeed our second promoter, Mr. Kanda. I think because of the official connections I had through my wife. And that also made me a bit of a novelty in the gym. Also, I could speak Thai, so I could understand what was going on around me. So that gave me an advantage.
Well, I looked at some films of some of these fights from the Rompo Gym and other places. There's a Russian documentary. They are brutal. Do you think you've had any residual effects?
Yeah, every guy carries an injury around with them. I mean, I've injured pretty much every part of my body, both my knees, my legs, my back, my eyes. And it catches up with you. And you have to know when to draw out of the game because you can sustain permanent damage. And you don't have any, you know, rather like these student athletes here who are exploited, you don't have any workman's comp or anything like that. And it's very hard to get insurance for that. I mean, at the moment, I'm getting my teeth fixed. And that's all down to the fights that I had.
Well, Alexander Reynolds, you be careful out there, and thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Alexander Reynolds is a writer and journalist based in the UK. His article for Vice, The Seedy Underworld of Muay Thai Boxing, along with some videos from the notorious Rompo Gym, are on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Up next on Word of Mouth, the filmmaker asks a provocative question. Can a real productive conversation happen if the privileged majority can't even name what it means to be white? We're going to learn about the Whiteness Project after the news. One Word of Mouth continues.